Accession number 27347, reel 22.
Stanley Brand, reel 22.
What were conditions like? I'm thinking of living conditions on board a Mack ship.
They were pretty good, because the food used to be taken aboard on the other side of the Atlantic. Any chief steward, purser, would always arrange to victual on the other side, except for the things that wouldn't last. He'd take fresh bread aboard in Glasgow or Liverpool, but the ham and all the treats, the sugar and the jams and marmalades and so on, he got over the other side. But there was an offset to this. Whilst we had good food, some of it was spoiled in that we hadn't got refrigerators big enough to cater for 130 people instead of 30. So they had fly mesh compartments down on the oil deck in which they'd keep meat. It would be the first to be used, obviously, but by the time it was used, it generally had a delicious background of fuel oil to it. The odd fly might get in too, and might have the odd few maggots in it. We used to have cracker hash quite a lot during the first few days of a voyage, while they used up the meat from the open larders on the oil deck. The other snag, the big snag, was the trade union rules, which were strictly applied, and even the skipper couldn't disobey them. Mealtimes were fixed according to the watches. In other words, because there'd be a morning watch 4 a.m. to 8 a.m. The galley would be open for half an hour before the watch change and half an hour after, and this went on through the day. And because overtime rates had to be paid outside those opening hours, and the overtime rates were pretty expensive for the shipping company. The shipping companies had issued instructions way back in September 1939 that under no circumstances will meals be served outside the half an hour before and half an hour after. And nobody had ever thought of altering that, because routine aboard ship was so steady that, all right, you could set your watches by when the cocoa was available. But when you've got people flying at all hours of the day and night, controlled by dawn and dusk, and I'd better enlarge on that, the most vulnerable time for a submarine was when it had been on the surface during the night charging its batteries, and finding that the batteries weren't fully charged because of the manoeuvres it had to do, they could do with an extra hour of charging. Shall we stay on the surface for the first hour after dawn, or should we go below? The same at dusk. Dare we come up half an hour before dusk and start charging on the surface? They're at their most vulnerable just after dawn, just before dusk. They were also vulnerable at midday, when they wanted to be on the surface to take a sunshot with their oh dear, Alzheimer's disease prevailing here. With their sextant. They want to do a sun shot. So we used to like to be in the air from dawn to an hour after dawn, an hour before dusk to dusk, and an hour either side of noon, when we had a better chance of catching them on the surface. So that our desire to fly was always governed by the time of dawn, the time of dusk. Noon was always there. So noon, unfortunately, was a change of watch. And if we were going to be airborne an hour before and an hour after, we were outside the eating time. If we were away at dawn and dawn was at 7:30, we missed our breakfast. If dusk was at 6:30 at night, we'd miss our evening meal because the watches at that time of day are 2 hours instead of 4 hours. So that the Merchant Navy, sticking to the rules, wouldn't provide us with food or even a hot drink between maybe going off for a dawn patrol when it wasn't available, then having a noon patrol and it's not available, and an evening patrol when it's not available. We could go 24 hours without any food, and if you went in the drink, especially in midwinter, your chances of survival were nil. We used to buy tins of corned beef, tins of beans, anything that we could heat up with a bucket of water with a steam pipe in it. The chief engineers were marvellous. They catered for our needs that way. There were one or two skippers who took it upon themselves to pay the overtime out of their own pocket if it could be done on odd occasions, but if it became a regular thing, he had to break the rules, pay them out of ship's funds, and get the reputation of being an unwise master with his company, which wouldn't stand him in good stead after the war.
What about your accommodation on board?
The accommodation was added, so it was pretty good. We were two to a cabin, which excluded our air gunners from us, which was straight-laced Navy habit. We would have broken that if we could. Unfortunately, we couldn't. The batsman very often had to share with a surgeon, but in some cases he had his own private cabin, which was fine. The air staff officer had his own single cabin as well. One problem with the cabins was that they had steel walls. It was bitterly cold outside. It was warm inside because we had fuel oil to burn. We had steam heating. We used to get a lot of condensation running down the walls. And with the bed lockers up against the wall, any clothes we had in the locker under our bed could get damp and mildew. Still, we were glad of the heat. The other thing was, of course, aboard an oil tanker, smoking was restricted to one or two special places. Fortunately, our sleeping quarters allowed us to smoke, and the crew room allowed us to smoke. And cigarettes were a tin of 50 for a shilling. I'm looking very nostalgic at the moment. We used to get senior service, Capstan full strength, Churchman's number one, seagoing woodbines, which were the same size as a senior service or a Capstan or a player's. Woodbines were again the same price as the others, but they were very satisfying smoke. Yes, very nostalgic about that.
Would most of the crew in those days smoke?
Yes, it was a done thing. If you notice any picture of pilots and observers in conditions where smoking was permitted, they nearly all have a cigarette or a pipe. It was the done thing. It was I don't know, it was like Brill Cream for the raft.
Can we talk a little bit about how the flying was organised on board that ship?
Yes, the air staff officer used to advise the Merchant Navy skipper when flying could take place. The senior officer of the escort could dictate to the MAC ship, and therefore to the skipper, when a patrol was necessary and where it was necessary, because he would be in full possession of the facts. We had in the convoy, they had radio telephony with a very restricted range where they could keep track of any warning that somebody had an ASDIC contact, and there would the senior officer of the escort would decide what flying was necessary, dictate it to the skipper and the air staff officer. The air staff officer would say whether it was possible. The Merchant Navy skipper would say whether it was feasible from a ship handling point of view, depending where he was, how close the other ships were, and so on. The air staff officer used to inform the flight commander, you will fly at such and such a time, you will fly one aircraft, two aircraft, three aircraft, and their area of search will be so and so. There were code names for each type of search, alligators, but each area had a code name, generally after a reptile, cobras, mambas, and so on. And this would mean going out on a course for a distance and then step aside and then come back, usually a triangular search, either ahead or on the beam or in astern.
Would the code words then designate the area of search rather than the type of search?
Yes, it would give the area by giving a course a bearing, a distance, a step aside onto another course, a distance, and then back a course, not necessarily a distance.
So with these, this would be if you were doing a specific search, would it, for if there'd been a contact?
If they thought, yes, there was a U-boat out in that area, they'd cover it with these searches.
And would you also do a patrol when there was no contact?
Oh, yes. We used to do patrols for dawn, noon and dusk, as I explained, because these were the times you were most likely to catch them on the surface. We also used to do the job of grounding up stragglers. After a storm, or when a convoy was forming up, you always had stragglers, people who were out of position. Finding them and giving them a course and distance to get back to the convoy was very important, because a straggler had no defence away from the convoy. He was most vulnerable. He could be picked off by a submarine coming to the surface and using his ordinary gun and conserving his torpedoes. They were sitting ducks. So one of our main jobs was rounding up stragglers. This was fine as long as they were ahead or abeam of the convoy. It's when they were astern of the convoy, going westwards, that we didn't like it, because generally winds in the Atlantic were coming from the west. A convoy going into wind, and with stragglers astern of the convoy, we had to go well astern of the convoy searching, and then having found them and given them a course back to the convoy, we had to get back to the convoy, which meant upwind, convoy going away from us. And at the end of a patrol, when our petrol was at its lowest, if the wind freshened and ended up with a 40 knot wind, it was significant. We could end up by running out of petrol, and that happened to quite a few people. The other problem was that to get off these short decks, we had to have a fine pitch propeller, like being in bottom gear. We couldn't have a gearbox, we couldn't have a variable speed propeller such as the RAF had, because the RAF had cornered all the production capacity for variable speed propellers. Rotol were fully committed by contract to the RAF, and they couldn't spare any for the Swordfish. So we had a fixed pitch propeller, and it had to be a fine pitch. So it was like being in bottom gear the whole time, drinking petrol, reducing our speed. For instance, normally the airspeed of the cruising airspeed of a Swordfish would be about 90 knots. At 1900 revs, but my cruising speed was 72 knots at 2200 revs. You can imagine the way it drank petrol to do 72 miles instead of 90 miles. It drank petrol because the revs had gone up from 1900 to 2200, so that if you're astern of the convoy and you had to go upwind to catch it up, and it was going away from you, everything was against you. So patrols astern of the convoy were the least popular.
What other positions would you patrol in? Obviously, you would do the astern patrols, but what were the other ones? Would you sometimes go ahead of the convoy?
Oh yes, if due to Enigma, which we didn't know about, but there were signals to the senior officer of the escort from the Admiralty saying avoid area so and so and so and so and so and so. If that was just ahead of us, they would send aircraft to that area to keep them down. If you hadn't got any Enigma information, we didn't know it was Enigma, but we didn't know where it came from, but if we didn't have any warning of submarines about, we used to patrol on the flanks of the convoy, because if the convoy had been spotted by a U-boat and he'd been able to marshal U-boats towards the convoy, they would submerge, try to attack, and then after the convoy had passed, they would surface, try to get round the convoy on the surface at full speed using their diesels. So by patrolling out on the flanks of the convoy, on the beam of the convoy, we would intercept, or we would hope to intercept. It was one way of keeping them under.
And how would your flying, say for the routine patrols, be rotated? How would that work?
How would it
be rotated? Who would do what? When would they do it?
We'd take turns. It depended on the need for the number in the air, but obviously the flight commander would try to rest people as much as possible. If he knew that you'd had two patrols in the day for 2.5 hours each, he'd try to avoid giving you a third, especially under freezing conditions. They would try to make patrolling as realistic as possible.
You touched on something there about the weather conditions.
Yeah.
What conditions would you operate in? What's the optimum condition that you would be happy to operate in, and what would the ones that you were not happy to?
The ones I would be happy to operate in were if we had a positive sighting. We would have flown under almost any condition. For patrols purely to keep them down and to be seen, we would want reasonable conditions. Now, reasonable conditions, I would say, were deck going up and down through 15 feet, wind speeds of up to 25 knots, maybe it's 30 knots. I'd be happier at 25 knots. visibility, naturally, nobody likes flying in fog, but we used to fly when we were coming up to the Newfoundland banks. We knew we'd be going into fog. We still flew. Because, of course, in foggy conditions, a U-boat would be quite happy to come up on the surface. And if we could be lucky enough to come out of a fog bank and see him there, that was ideal. We could attack.
Obviously, there are problems navigating back to the ship, though, if you're in fog. How was that managed?
No more difficult than navigating at night or navigating even in daylight. The only thing is that we could see the convoy from a much greater distance, and we'd know that we were safe much sooner in the daytime than we would at night or in fog. In fog, I did have one or two nasty experiences where I had to come back to the ship in fog, and on one occasion, the only indication I had that there was a convoy there was, first of all, black smoke coming up from somebody whose boilers needed cleaning, and coal fired, of course. But I could just see mast tops going through the fog, just like a periscope, except that they weren't creating a wake the way a periscope creates in water. But I managed to see mast tops. We painted our mast top in fluorescent paint after that, and quite a few other people did it as well. The difficulty is, of course, that you can't tell the course of the ship in fog. All you know is what course it was following when you left, and you could set that on your gyro compass, and you could come in on that course, so that you'd be more or less down the centre line of the ship. But that only applied when she was steaming with the convoy. When she turned into wind, you lost it. It was a horrible experience to I suppose during real foggy conditions there's so little wind that we assumed that she was on the course of the convoy, and generally that would be the case, but you'd come into land and you might suddenly find a bridge work looming up in front of you, and you had to be ready for avoiding action. So we used to approach as slowly as we could, flying in the tail down condition, hanging on the prop, and if you saw the deck, you just manoeuvred and closed the throttle. It was by guess and by God.
Would you be able to communicate with the ship at all in those conditions?
No, because we only had Morse code in those days. We didn't have radio telephony. We couldn't communicate with the ship except by Aldis lamp, which was slow. And if, under certain conditions, you couldn't even use Aldis lamp, if you had to leave the air gunner behind, because the conditions, the wind conditions were light, and you wanted maximum takeoff power, you'd leave the observer, leave the air gunner behind, which meant that everything depended on the observer, and he had enough to do to get you back to the convoy in fog conditions, rather than be working an Aldis lamp. No, fog was quite a nightmare.
What about rough conditions? Because I take it there are conditions that you, you know, if the wind speed was such that in the Atlantic that you simply couldn't operate.
Yes, as I say, when the deck was going up and down through 25, 30 feet, the only thing that would make us operate was a U-boat on the surface somewhere.
Would U-boats be less likely to operate, though, in the same, if they were having problems with the weather as well? Does it make it difficult?
When the weather was like that, U-boats liked to stay under, but they could only stay under for a certain length of time. Sooner or later they had to come to the surface to operate their diesels and to charge their batteries.
Would they be unlikely to attack, though, in poor weather conditions?
Oh, no, they'd like it, because under poor weather conditions, even if we were allowed to use our radar, the conning tower would be lost in the reflections from waves, and it's difficult to see a conning tower in any sort of a sea, where the breakers, wherever there's white water, it's almost impossible to see a submarine on the surface even.